just carried out.
I think we'll get started. So welcome everyone to the second in the Life Living series. First of all, a few entities to thank for making this event possible. I am Donna Lombra from United Way, and United Way is one of the sponsors, along with the New Ulm Public Library, the New Ulm Community Ed Department, and New Ulm Park and Rec, who provide the facility. I'm happy to introduce our speaker tonight. Gloria England has turned her family's personal tragedy into a very public lesson of hope, help, and healing. She is the author of Living in the Wake of Addiction, Lessons for Courageous Caregiving. I know she will inspire us all how to better understand the illness of addiction. It's my pleasure to introduce Gloria England.
So what I'm going to do tonight is talk from my heart. And if you can't, when I go to something like this, if I can't see someone, their face, it bothers me. So if you can't see my face because I'm sitting down here on ground level, please move up or move around so you're comfortable. So thank you, Donna. Where'd you go? There you are. For that introduction, and I also want to give a special shout out for Hank and Eileen Campbell for letting Donna know about me. I really appreciate that. Just a little bit more information about me. I've been an ally of the recovery community for over 35 years, and what that means to me is that I have lots of family members and friends who have been in long-term recovery from alcohol and other illegal drugs. And for my dearest, oldest sibling, my brother, who has been in recovery for 37 years, what that's meant to him is that he's got a chance to live a very full life in his recovery. He's been present to his children, his grandchildren. He's been very present to my family, just like the other 23.5 million people that are in recovery. I think it's really important to know that people do recover from this illness. It takes the right support at the right time, but people do recover. And that was a real challenge for me when my son died of a heroin overdose in 2007. I am a person that's always seen the glass half full. And I saw the glass half empty for a long time after he died. I just lost all my hope of recovery. And then I found out about an organization called Minnesota Recovery Connection that was just starting in the Twin Cities. And a lot of the services, all the services they offer are offered to the community at no cost. There's also a recovery community organization in Mankato called Recovery is Happening. That is also very active in that community. And what that did for me was let me see that there is hope for recovery, because there were a lot of services then that were being offered in 2010, a lot of different pathways to recovery that were being offered that my son and I didn't know about, that were then Minnesota Recovery Connection was shedding the light on those. And so that's where I've always been a psychotherapist. I didn't practice that for many years, but that's where I went to get my recovery coaches training. And I can honestly say I wouldn't be sitting in front of you if it wouldn't be for Minnesota Recovery Connection. I just owe my life and my what must be third career to Minnesota Recovery Connection. So I do work although I do a lot of volunteer work for them and advocacy work for them, I do work professionally as a recovery coach. So I support people who are seeking recovery from the use of alcohol, drugs, food, relationships. My specialty is supporting family members who have a loved one who is dealing with an active addiction and relapse, or really struggling to find the right path for them. And as Donna mentioned, I published a book last year. So what I want to do was talk and also read some excerpts from my book, and then, is this an hour program? Is that okay? And then I'll stop, hopefully, you know, so we have 10 or 15 minutes for questions. Does that sound okay? So if you have a burning question when I'm talking, you think I'm gonna forget, interrupt me, okay? Otherwise, we'll save the questions for the end. So I wanna just read a little bit about, because people always say to me, one of the questions I get asked most often is, why did you write this book? So I'm gonna read a little bit here from my introduction. I wrote this book with two main convictions in mind. I hope sharing my journey will provide the education, courage, and support you need to keep a loving relationship and healthy boundaries with the person in your life who has a substance use disorder. And does everybody know what a substance use disorder is? Do you know that's another term for addiction? That's the politically correct word we're using now. So it covers all addictions that involve a substance. So when the American Psychological Association came out with their newest diagnostical manual, they said that for some people, the word addiction, addict, alcoholic can be stigmatizing, and so they changed the language. So I just wanted to let you know why I'm saying that. Although Aaron's untimely death might mean to some that we all failed or failed him, his life story reminds me that the cliche is true. It is the journey that's most important, not just the destination. I hope what I learned will not only begin a healing process between you and your loved one, but will also provide the foundation for deeper healing for you personally. The healing may take place while the person with the substance use disorder in your life recovers and lives, or God forbid, it may take place after his death, as it did for me. But I do believe both of you will experience less pain, guilt, and shame because of the experiences I lived and learned from and now share with you. Aaron always said, as an addict, my life has no purpose. All I do is spend my time trying to get sober. I believed he would find his purpose once he recovered, but I realize now his life was inherently purposeful, even as a person who did not sustain recovery before he died. He made a difference in the way that I and others close to him learn to detach with compassion and choose unconditional love while still maintaining healthy boundaries. If this book helps one person, the lessons Aaron taught us will continue. The other reason why I wrote this book is that I really wanted to bring to people's awareness the fact that this is a chronic relapsing illness. It doesn't have anything to do with people's character or lack of willpower. And you will hear this theme over and over again tonight as I try to explain it in as many ways as I possibly can to make sure that people understand what I'm saying. And so in my book, you'll hear me refer to it as a brain illness because the brain has been flooded by chemicals that get it out of balance. That's the simplest way I can, you know, after use and abuse over and over again, the brain becomes dependent upon, you know, the neurotransmitters that receive the opiates that, you know, we all have opiates in our brain that make us feel better. And when we use more opiates and flood the brain with those chemicals, then the brain becomes dependent upon them. And as an aside to that, I just heard a gentleman by the name of Gabor Mate. Have anybody heard of him? He wrote a book called In the Realm of the Hungry Ghost. I went to a conference that he was giving all day last Friday, and it totally blew me away because his theory is, and he's on, you can see his videos on YouTube if you want to get a taste for his name is spelled G-A-B-O-R-M-A-T-E. He's he was the first generation from the Nazi concentration camps. And he says that the brain does not develop, you know, through childhood and infancy and childhood. It doesn't develop in a vacuum. It develops as the person is exposed to certain environments. Now, that has to do with the environment in utero. It has to do with, you know, the physical environment, where you're living, you know, what kind of a family life you have, what kind of stress your parents are under, your mother is under when she carries you. And he works in some of the most heavily drug-using areas in Vancouver, Canada, and he's been there for years. And so he works with lots of people who have suffered from this illness for many, many years. And as he's ran his own studies with folks, what he's found out is those who have the most trauma in their life suffer the most from mental illness and addiction. So his theory is that addiction isn't a brain illness. People are more susceptible to addiction and mental illness because of the what happens to the brain as people try to deal with the stressors in their life. And to me, this makes common sense. You know, my son had a lot of stresses in his life. Number one, he was an extremely bright, sensitive person. And those people don't get along in the world really well, right? I'm kind of one of those people too. You know, I was brought up, my parents were always saying to me, "You're too sensitive, Gloria." Well, I mean, how can somebody be too sensitive? I think that's a good thing, right? Raise your hand if you think it's okay to be sensitive. And I know that Aaron was that way too. And I was in a very unhappy marriage when I was carrying him. And I'm sure in utero he felt that. I'm sure he felt the stressors of the marriage. And I just think that he came out, you know, into this world with a lot of things to deal with. And the one thing that Mr. Matei stressed over and over again is that we cannot blame ourselves. This isn't a blame game for parents to take on or caregivers. But I think it's something to really think about, it because it kind of makes logical sense to me. So that was a big aside. But I just can't help but when I find out these new thoughts, I always want to share them with people, because I think the thing that my son and I and our family suffered the most from was lack of education. And with this illness or any other chronic illness, knowledge is always power. The more you know, the more you can advocate for, the more you can help, the more you can support, the more you can take, you know how to take care of yourself. So, let's see, I'm going to skip some of this here. Recognizing that Aaron had an incurable disease also supported me in my mission to detach with the same love and compassion I would if he had any other incurable illness. It then became imperative that I work diligently to educate Aaron's family and others about these facts. Aaron couldn't will himself to be healed from this disease any more than he could have willed heart disease or diabetes to disappear from his body. Substance use disorder, heart disease, and diabetes are all diseases from which one can experience recovery. One of my mentors, William Colt Moyers, who is the vice president of Hazel and Betty Ford in the Twin Cities, he likes to use the word, instead of recovery, he likes to use the word remission, because he feels as though that's a more understandable word to the general public. So are all diseases from which one can experience remission with the correct combination of self-care, medications, and lifestyle changes. When one is in recovery from all these diseases, symptoms may not be present. But when relapse happens and the symptoms surface, it's clear that the disease process is alive and present. I also agree with the experts who say that accepting addiction as a brain disorder does not mean the person with a substance use disorder isn't responsible for her recovery from this disease. When she does ask for help and is willing to accept the tools for recovery into her life, healing is possible. Like a diabetic who manages diabetes with medication, a person seeking recovery must take the responsibility to manage her substance use disorder through treatment, experience, and/or recovery meetings and therapeutic support. And guess what? When they ask for help, the services need to be available to them. And I'm just amazed. It's been almost 10 years since my son died, and I'm still having people tell me that they have to wait 2 weeks for an evaluation, 2 months to get into treatment. And with the brain out of balance with this disease, you know, the definition of addiction is compulsive drug seeking despite harmful consequences, right? And so when the stars line up and that person asks for help, we as a community, as a state, as a country, as a nation, we owe it to these people, like we have all the people that have heart disease and cancer, to have services available. And that isn't happening. I hear this over and over again. So I'll get down off of that little pedestal now. It's a big issue with me. A lot of people think that this is a choice, that addiction is a choice. Because they'll say, well, they may have initiated, you know, made the initial choice to try the alcohol, the pot, the cocaine, whatever. But is there anybody here that's ever tried alcohol? Pot? I mean, you don't need to raise, I mean, you know, a lot of people try drugs, right? And maybe, you know, you are in that 10% of that population or the 90% of the population who, you know, it's not going to affect your brain like it does someone else who maybe has more stress in their life. I mean, if that is the key, whose brain isn't as you know, ready to grab on to these, you know, more dopamine, more, you know, that opiates receptors haven't been flooded by some other stressor in their life. You know, we don't know. And so although we all may choose to experiment or pick up, that doesn't mean we choose to be, you know, have a substance use disorder. So it's kind of like a peanut allergy. You know, people will eat peanuts once or twice or three times, and then maybe the third or fourth time they eat them, their tongue swells up, or, you know, they have anaphylactic shock. And so I think we need to think about it in that way. We do not know how that those substances are going to respond, or our body's going to respond to those substances until we use them. So because this is an illness that is characterized by compulsive drug seeking despite harmful consequences, without treatment, without any kind of intervention, I really think it's important to understand that the compulsion is stronger than your basic need to feed yourselves. I mean, if you have ever been in relationship with someone who has been ill with this disease, have you noticed that they might buy their drug of choice before they feed themselves or before they feed their family, right? That's how strong this compulsion is. I think it's really important to understand that. So it becomes more important than feeding themselves or clothing themselves or making sure there's a roof over their head. So the illness isn't about the quality of somebody's character or willpower or poor choices, and the behaviors that often accompany it, the deception, the seemingly lack of character and lack of judgment, and you know, they appear very self-centered, right, and not compassionate towards the people who are trying to help them. Those are symptoms of the illness, not the cause. And I don't know about you, but I had it backwards. I thought my son, at one time I thought my son was a sociopath. I mean, I had all kinds of labels on him, you know, because he would lie, cheat, steal, you know, deceive to get his drugs. And so I thought he was a liar, cheater, you know, when in my heart, I knew who he was beforehand and it didn't add up to me. So I think it's really important to understand that these behaviors are symptoms of the illness. And if you see someone, when you talk about willpower, a symptom that people are really ill with this disease is when you know them to be a person that can do anything, but if they can't stop using, you know they're really sick. And so that's where looking at willpower comes in. So it's a way these behaviors that they develop are a way that they try to survive the illness. And for a long time, I did not treat my son as though he was chronically ill. I treated him like he was chronically defective. And I'm very grateful that I learned to turn that around before he died, but I think it's just really, I can remember sitting in church one day, and it kind of came to me, and I don't even know what was said, but I thought, my goodness, I'm willing to help the person on the street corner help more than I am my own son. What is wrong with this picture? So if you're going to be involved with someone, and this was always my conundrum, if I'm going to have a relationship with him, how am I going to draw appropriate boundaries? How am I going to learn to do the right things? How am I not going to enable him? So I think it's the very first chapter in my book. You would think I'd have all this memorized, wouldn't you? Yeah, it is the first chapter. I call it caregiving versus codependent. And so I'm just going to read a little bit from there, because this is one of the questions that I get asked over and over again. So this section of the book is referring to a time when my son had been gone from home for a long time. I knew he was involved with drugs. In fact, I knew he was supporting his habit by dealing drugs. And he called me and told me he was going to move back to the Twin Cities. And I was, you know, it was like a double-edged sword. I was going to be very happy to have him back, but how in the heck was I going to protect my other three boys from him and my sanity? And so I'm just going to read a little excerpt. So that kind of sets the scene for you. Even though he wasn't living with us when he was in town, learning to practice self-care and love him unconditionally really became a challenge whenever we were in contact on a regular basis. This was a continual process of letting go of my judgment and my preconceived sense of control over Aaron and his addiction. Dedicating myself to my codependency support group was a key component of self-care. Drawing healthy personal boundaries around requests from Aaron also became an integral part of taking care of me. When he made a request, I asked myself how it was going to affect both of us as well as our family. Excuse me a minute. And these are the questions that I ask always, you know, I had them on the inside door of my desk in my office and also on the side of the refrigerator. Was it going to, you know, anything that he asked me to do for him, was it going to encourage his drug use or his recovery? Was it going to endanger his health and well-being if I didn't follow through with his request? In other words, if he called and said, "Mom, somebody beat me up. I'm on a street corner. I'm bleeding." Let's see. I'm not going to stand there and say, "Gee, how many times have I done this before? I'm going to go pick him up." Right? How would it impact the rest of us? Was I going to resent helping if it meant requiring a change in my work or family schedule, or could I do it from a place of joy and love because it felt as right for all of us as it did for him? In an effort to make better choices about Aaron's specific requests, I also began to run them by my husband, Bob, who was Aaron's stepfather, before giving Aaron my decision. As Aaron's stepfather, he was not as emotionally enmeshed and had a more detached perspective. For example, Aaron might call and say, "I forgot I have a doctor's appointment today and it's too late to catch the bus. Can you please give me a ride?" This was like kind of an ongoing thing. Rather than dropping everything and running out the door, I'd say, "I'm right in the middle of something. I'm going to call you back in a minute." Now, in days prior, I would say, "I'll be right there, you know. I'll be right there. Gosh, you can't miss a doctor's appointment, right?" Then I'd call Bob and see if he had a moment to talk so I could explain the situation. He'd help me weigh the decision, what would be the best support for his recovery, giving Aaron the ride or letting him experience the consequences of missing the appointment. What effect would either decision have on both my well-being and our families? I also started responding to Aaron's request based upon present circumstances. Now, this was really hard for me because in the past, you know, he would ask me to do things over and over again, and then I would find that, you know, he'd want to ride to the doctor's appointment, and then, "Oh, by the way, can you stop and do this? Can you stop and do that?" So, you know, the request was initially one thing and kind of ended up being something else. And what I started looking is when he would make these same kind of requests over and over again, I'd think about other positives, if there were other positive changes I had seen in him. And then that would help me base it upon what he's asking right now. I think as caregivers, we tend to think, "Well, yeah, I've heard that before, and there's no way I'm going to do that again," right? But if we can really be in the present moment and look and see if there's any other indication that there has been change, because people do change, even people with substance use disorders. And if they're trying to recover, we want to give them all the support that we possibly can. Now, I know that not everybody may have a Bob, like I do, to call up and ask, but I know that a couple of people in my Courageous Caregivers group said that they found friends or, you know, family members that cared about their loved one but were not quite as enmeshed. I mean, I felt like with Aaron, I had this cord about this thick, and we were connected. You know, it was just always pulling on me. And so it was really good to get a perspective from somebody else who cared but didn't have that deep, deep connection. And even if you can't talk to somebody, and some people that, you know, belong to Al-Anon would call their sponsor and talk to them, but even just to step back and just say, "I'm going to get back to you," unless it is an emergency, and then just think, just go through those questions. Is it going to support his recovery or his drug use? Am I going to resent it? You know, what's in it for me and what's in it for him? So the other thing that I hope this book would do would end the stigma and discrimination of that those with substance use disorder and their family members face in almost every arena of their life, both when they are seeking recovery and after they are in remission. Making addiction about a person's character and choices or willpower has allowed us to blame the person for their illness. And I've talked about this before. Do we blame those with diabetes, heart disease, or asthma for their illness? If it's only a personal health issue for those with the substance use disorder, then the national epidemic that is going right now is only the person's problem. It's not society's problem, it's not the medical community's problem, nor the law enforcement's problem. And that's how this stigma stays alive, because we have not taken any national, a lot of us haven't taken local, state, let alone family, responsibility for this illness. I mean responsibility in talking about it, accepting it as an illness, and trying to do everything we can to get them help. So there's still 144 people dying every single day. That is like, you know, the plane that, one of the planes during 9/11 that went into the cornfield, right, had 120 people on it. That's like a plane crash every single day. Why isn't our government responding to these people? Why? What keeps that? I think it's the stigma. The other thing I want people, family members, to be aware of is the effect that this illness can have on other siblings in the family. And I dedicated a whole chapter in my book to that, because Aaron's birth brother, Jeff, and he's named in the book, and he approved the chapter. So he knows that I talk about him and knows that I talk about this. It really, really had a huge effect on his life, and yet he got very little support for it. Because where does the attention always go when a child is ill? The parent. Oh, this must be so hard for you. What are you doing? And what does the parent usually do? The parent focuses on the sick child, not the well child that gets drugged to every family recovery support group there is. That, I mean, I don't think there was ever one time when my son Jeff had an activity and we had, you know, a family support meeting that I allowed him to go to his activity rather than that family support meeting, because, you know, everybody's supposed to be there. If he had a friend sometimes, then the parent would say, well, I'll take him. So my whole focus was on trying to save Aaron, and I did not do a very good job of supporting my other child, and it had repercussions in Jeff's relationship with Aaron, and Jeff and I are still working through some of the repercussions it had in our relationship. So I just want to mention how important it is to, and I know when somebody is chronically ill, how hard it is to pay attention to other people in the family, especially if they're good kids. And Jeff is a really good kid. You know, he just never was one of those demanding children. So it's easy for me to say, you know, you're fine, you're fine, you're fine. Thank God you're fine. So the other thing that I want to mention is how important it is if you're for the general public to be informed about medication-assisted treatment. Do you all know what I'm talking about? So I'm going to kind of do a general overview here. Medication-assisted treatment, and you'll see the acronym MAT, M-A-T. A lot of that, when you read literature, you might see it talked about that way, is the use of specific prescription medications to curb the cravings and compulsive drug seeking that is characterized by substance use disorder. Prescriptions most likely to be used for opioid use disorder, that would be heroin and prescription drugs. The two drugs most likely to be used are methadone and Suboxone, or Suboxone is the trade name. Buprenorphine is the generic name, or naltrexone. Methadone and Suboxone are opioids that bind to the opiate receptors in the brain the same manner as prescription opiates and heroin. But when taken as prescribed, they quell the cravings without creating an euphoric high. When taken as prescribed, when taken as prescribed, when taken as prescribed. Now, Trexone is a non-opiate medication, unlike methadone and Suboxone, that it is not an opiate. It does not create any euphoria. In fact, it blocks the opiate receptors in the brain, so no opiates can, you know, be received by the brain. So therefore, you're not, if you use an opiate when you're on naltrexone, you're not going to get the high. But for many people, it blocks the high, but it does not relieve the cravings. For many people, they must rely on Suboxone or methadone. Now, Trexone is very, very effective for many people with alcohol use disorder. And I remember sitting at a Minnesota Recovery Connection dinner one night at a table with a woman that had many relapses with her alcohol use disorder. And when she started using naltrexone, she was just amazed at how much it helped her. So because methadone and Suboxone can be misused, if people are not educated about the life-saving capabilities of the drugs, they may develop a stigmatized attitude about medication-assisted treatment that often keeps people from considering it as a viable recovery tool. And that was me. I had a lot of misinformed ideas. Both my son and I did. Aaron was not given the education he should have been given about methadone. And I just want to read a little bit from the when my awakening about that came. Unfortunately, it was 6 years after Aaron died. Let's see. My opinion about methadone as a viable MAT program didn't change until August of 2013, almost 6 years after Aaron's death. I attended an event sponsored by the Steve Rummer Hope Foundation and Minnesota Recovery Connection held at the Recovery Church in St. Paul, Minnesota. The program included a panel of speakers made up of addiction specialists, physicians, parents, and a person recovering from opioid use disorder who was on a methadone MAT program. This young man appeared to be in his late 20s, was a husband and a father, and was also a returning college student. Like Aaron, his past with methadone had not been a positive recovery experience until his mother said something that really changed his attitude. Thank God he heard his mother, right? Instead of using methadone as a crutch to simply alleviate your cravings, why don't you use it as a real recovery tool to stabilize yourself so you can go on and change your life? He explained this was the first time he really saw MAT as a way for him to recover and move ahead with his life. He stopped worrying about how long he might have to be on it, and he started really collaborating with his MAT physician to regulate his dosage so he could be alert enough to study and work, but still feel calm without being overly sedated. It was then that I realized I was still holding on to my own deep stigma about methadone. My views about MAT, and I think Aaron's as well, had kept us both from seeing methadone as a recovery tool. I will also say that when Aaron's last attempt, at recovery, that last year he was alive, and this was the whole time he was using methadone. The theory has changed dramatically since then. But he was, it always takes a while to regulate your dosage. And as soon as he would become stable, okay, Aaron, it's time to start titrating you down. I mean, he just barely gets stable, right? And then they'd start encouraging him to get off of it. And so it was this constant yo-yo back and forth. And then there's a lot of people that still that feel like, you know, okay, I'm stable on this, now it's time for me to get off of it. And they want to get off of it way too soon. And that is, I think, the biggest mistake that people that are on medication-assisted treatment make is they, I think it's the stigma that makes them think it's a crutch. You know, my husband takes heart medication. Do you think he's using a crutch? I mean, he's using a life-saving tool, right? And so we've got to really change our mind about this. In 2013, after talking with Aaron's last treatment physician, I was told that today, knowing what he knows about the research supporting medication-assisted treatment, he would have kept Aaron on Suboxone indefinitely. And that was not an option for my son in 2007. So we've got to make sure that the dollars are available for these people to stay on the medications that they need. I'm just going to say a few words here about relapse, because this is something that people talk, you know, oh, they relapsed again, or they relapsed again, they relapsed again. And there's a lot of recovery professionals that don't like people like me to say that relapse is part of recovery, but you know what? It is. It was for my husband. Don't you like it? You didn't know I talked about you like this, did you? Because he relapsed with his heart disease. He was one of those people that had good numbers, and we couldn't believe that he had heart disease. He's look at him. He's fit as a fiddle. Never been overweight. His numbers were all good, but both of his parents had heart disease. So he had this first incident, went on all the medication, and after a year, his numbers continued to be good. And he said, and he was having side effects from one of the medications. He said, I'm going to go off this. So he went off of it. What do you think happened within a year? He had another occurrence. And when he came back in the hospital, they didn't shame or blame him. They helped him. You know, he relapsed. And so that's the way we need to think about relapse. And the cravings, as I mentioned before, especially with opioid use disorder, the way that relapse happens is, you know, when you go into treatment, there's a period of abstinence, you know, during treatment or detox, when the body's tolerance then goes for opiates, goes way down, right? First, the brain has been flooded with too many, we take them away, and then, of course, the tolerance is way down. But the physical and emotional cravings are still there. And this craving can last for days, weeks, months. It can go on for a long, long time. And so when the craving is combined with the lower tolerance created by the period of abstinence, then you have a very deadly combination for overdose or overdose by death. And the other thing, so just remember that it's when somebody first gets out of treatment, that they really need a lot of support. And one thing that they're realizing now that, you know, the time inpatient treatment or the intensive outpatient treatment program, that is the tip of the iceberg. What happens for the 6 months, the year, the 2 years after, the kind of support the person gets, you know, peer recovery support, maybe they need therapy, maybe they have co-occurring disorders and they need mental health support also. And by the way, one thing I forgot to mention is that the co-occurrence of mental illness and substance use disorders is one of the things we're really realizing has a huge influence on both. So generally speaking, I mean, we don't know which comes, you know, first, the chicken or the egg, but anybody that has a mental health illness is 50% as likely to develop an addiction disorder, especially if the mental illness occurs early in their life, and the same is true for addiction. So if you have any inclination that your loved one has both, get them evaluated for both, because it's really important, because a lot of people that have a mental illness will be self-medicating with substances. So sorry for that aside. So cravings are another reason for relapses. The other thing is a term called euphoric recall, or the phenomenon of craving. Does anybody know about that? You do. Are you shaking your head yes back there? Back there in the striped shirt? Do you want to talk about it? No, okay. It's always nice to have somebody else talk besides me. So euphoric recall, I'd never heard this term until I read William Moyer's book called Now What, which is another book I would highly recommend. He defines euphoric recall as a steel trap set in the deepest recesses of our memory. The trap is primed to spring, says Moyers. If it does, we are once again caught in the excruciating grip of alcohol and other drugs. Always our pain is matched by our utter bafflement of how it happened. The background around this started in the 1930s with Dr. Silkworth, a physician who worked with Bill W. and other early members of Alcoholics Anonymous. Silkworth referred to it as a phenomenon of craving. Years later, MRIs and other technological tools allowed experts to see how the brain of those with this illness lit up, not only under the direct influence of addictive substances, but whenever images of liquor bottles, syringes, or lines of cocaine were flashed before them. I remember hearing a lecture one time about somebody counted how many billboards there were that the school bus, for advertising alcohol, that the school bus passed on the way to the high school. You know, so you think about that happening, and I'm going to just read a short excerpt from, I have a chapter in here about relapse, and I'm just going to read a short piece from experiencing that with Aaron. The day this relapse happened, I had been expecting Aaron to call mid-afternoon to ask for a ride home. And Aaron had almost 2 years of recovery under his belt. He was actually living with us in between a sober house and getting an apartment on his own. He was going back to school. He was getting EMDR therapy and DBT therapy. He was going to peer recovery support group, and he was stabilized on methadone. So everything was going really well for him. When he didn't call, I assumed he missed the bus or decided to stay in the city and meet someone for coffee. I really wasn't concerned about him being late. My phone finally rang at about 4:30, and the caller ID, you know, this was the time when we had landlines and caller IDs, right? Identified it as Aaron. I answered with, "Hi, honey, are you at the transit station or did you ride all the way out to the bus stop?" But all I could hear was muffled sobs on the other end of the line. For a moment, I thought I had misread the caller ID. "Aaron, is that you? Hello. Aaron, what's going on?" "Mom, I don't even remember getting into the car," he sobbed. "I don't remember even making a decision to use. And Mom, there were kids in the front seat. I can't believe I shot up with kids in the front seat. I promised myself I would never, ever use in front of kids. All I wanted was a ride. The next thing I remember is coming round and feeling high like I had used. And I did. I feel crazy. I mean, really nuts. I used, and I don't even remember making the decision to do that. Based on all the success Aaron had experienced the previous 2 years, I could hardly believe what I was hearing. But what I could believe was the extreme pain, shame, and disbelief he was feeling. It was like no other using experience he had ever shared with me. For Aaron, this trap had been triggered by simply seeing and conversing with an old using buddy that offered him a ride. So that's how easy it can happen for people. So I'm going to stop now. The one other thing I want to close with is that the other thing I think is really important to do when you're in relationship with someone with this illness is focus on what they are doing right. God knows that they know what they're doing wrong. We don't need to remind them about all their missed appointments, about missing recovery meetings, about, you know, their real, nobody feels worse than they do when they relapse, right? And so however small their success, if it's that they've got clean clothes on, you haven't seen them in clean clothes for a while, if they got a haircut and they haven't had a haircut, I mean, anything you can do to give them a compliment, to make them feel good about themselves, I think is really an important thing to do. Thank you so much for your attention. I really appreciate it.